Welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders. Today, we're very excited to have with us Sabrina Ng, a seasoned industry professional who has worked across both startups as well as MNCs and across different countries and different corporate cultures. And we're very excited to have her share with us her insights, her experiences more today. Welcome, Sabrina.
Thank you, Debbie.
So as a start, I would love to learn a bit more about your day-to-day work in your last role at HSBC Life as the Synergy Director.
Okay, so in that role, I was... So HSBC Life had acquired Access Singapore, and there was a lot of work to integrate two organizations. And really, there was three different integrations going on, because there was the integration of the HSBC's insurance business with the AXA insurance business. And there was also, you know, the integration of this business within the wider group business, the banking business, right? So many different layers. In that role, you know, because I have a generalist background, it meant that I could take care of many different aspects of the changes that transition, right? So you could think about it, right? People come in, they need new work passes, they need, you know, access to new premises, they need new laptops. You have that change on that one level. The next level, you have to think about, okay, so now, you know, two different organizations, different organizational structures, how do we put them together? How do we line people up for equity? How do we put them together in a team to work well together, right? And then, you know, another layer is also just thinking externally. We're suddenly one brand. How do we tell that story to the external world that we are one brand, you know, and yet behind the scenes, you're paddling like mad because the back end processes are still different. Yeah. But to the external world, we have to try to seem unified. Yeah.
Okay. And you know, you spend quite a bit of time advising companies on their transformational transactions as well as projects. And you have a background in investment banking as well as strategy consulting. How has that background prepared you for these advisory roles that you have taken on?
So investment banking and strategy consulting has given me a really strong toolkit and a really broad toolkit, which, you know, covers a lot about financial performance, right? You learn about operational drivers, right? And you're able to kind of see across the range. And also in these careers, I have had the opportunity to work across different industries. So, you know, I've looked at toilet cleaning.
Oh.
Seriously?
That's very interesting.
Conference venues. Advertising agencies, airlines, right? And, you know, and that kind of training, as you were mentioning, it gives you that muscle to be able to, you know, dip into a new industry very quickly or get into a new situation really quickly and, you know, very quickly figure out what's going on and very quickly also try to figure out, you know, what are the potential solutions, you know, and where all the downstream and upstream implications could be.
And as you are, you know, driving change and leading these transformational projects across these different industries and corporate cultures, as you have mentioned, what were some of the similarities and differences that you have noticed?
I think the biggest underrated similarity is how important people are in this journey of change, right? Being able to bring people along that journey and kind of also whilst also identifying, you know, who cannot be brought along on that journey is a really key part.
Yeah.
Right. And then the rest, you know, once you kind of figure out the people piece on how you figure out the people, then it's about adapting some of the processes to the particular circumstance of it. Yeah. So, you know, different corporate cultures, the way you bring someone along in a large corporate will be very different from how you bring someone along in a startup environment, right? And there's an element of self-selection. The people that work in a startup will be very different from the people that work in a large corporate.
Yeah. And do you have any examples to share on some of these differences that you have observed?
I guess in a large corporate, you know, to change, you have to think through it. The change, your larger pool of people, your communication chain is longer, right? And, you know, you can't just send out one email. You'll have to do a lot of follow-ups. The process is a lot straight. Whereas in a startup, getting the word out is just much more nimble.
Yeah.
Yeah, and getting that instant feedback is also probably much more nimble.
and building on that, like within the APAC region, which you have spent the later part of your career on, what were some of the unique challenges or scenarios that you've observed, especially in the companies that you've worked with, that make it quite interesting for you to be driving these organizational changes?
I think as Asians, we tend to be a little bit more reserved. Okay. So we don't provide that feedback as quickly, or, you know, we tend to want to wait and see a little bit more. So, you know, and that sometimes gives people, people end up becoming resentful about the change rather than saying, hey, you know, maybe we can do something about it. So most recently, one of the things we had to do was to change the process, upgrade it to a higher standard of compliance, which meant that there's a lot more extra work for people, right? And, you know, ideally, optimally, what we should have done is say, okay, let's take a step back. Let's think about, you know, what is the principle behind why we want to make this change? Mm-hmm. And let's see, you know, whether there are any adjustments that we could do to the process to help it meet the objectives, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, whether it's an interim thing. But I think, you know, being Asians, we're like, oh, okay, you know, look, the boss says we got to do this. So, all right, we go to do this, even if it kills us, even if it means that people are working till 9 or 10 p.m. at night, we're going to do it. Mm. All right? I mean, who knows? In hindsight, maybe even us challenging it, maybe even us trying to adapt the process wouldn't have worked out, but that was just, we didn't make that attempt in the first place.
Yeah. And interesting that you mentioned a little bit about alignment. Typically, there are, in a simplified manner, there's two forms of alignment. There's the top alignment, so getting the leadership team or the management team to be aligned. And then there is the next form of alignment, which is you need to get the teams buy-in to the entire organizational change that you're trying to drive towards. What were some of the strategies that you have adopted to be able to drive both form of alignment and also the cross alignment?
I think it's so for the top team, obviously, you know, you'd be doing regular briefings, explaining to them. But a lot of the change that happens is minutia.
Okay.
It's more stuff that happens to people's day to day. And, you know, that senior level are more likely to delegate and say, okay, you know, talk to my guys, right? So where we focus on in terms of driving that change is engaging the kind of middle level of managers, right? Because they understand their team's workflow the best. So they are able to put in better input into the process. And so one of the things we do, is to run focus groups, right? Walk them through. Okay, so this is our hypothesis of what the new workflow would look like, right? If we were to make this change. What do you guys think? Give us inputs, you know, tell us your use cases so that we can try to work this out. You know, we're not going to make everybody happy. We're not going to stay to the old process. We have to change the process, but we can try to lessen the pain. And in some ways, that focus group not only gives people the chance, this middle managers a chance to provide the feedback, to improve the process, but it also gives them a bit of a sense of ownership into the new process. It also, you know, makes them kind of our next line of promoters to them, so that they are, when the change happens, they can explain the change to their next level and the next level below.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And you know, especially in the APAC region, there's a lot of different cultures across different regions as well. How do you see that being an additional layer that you have to drive towards organizational changes?
You know, I think it's really understanding, goes back to people. Mm-hmm. You, in every office, you got to understand who are the influences, right? And how that communication happens within an office, right? Some officers, you can send them an email and they get it, right? Some officers, you need to, you know, have the right person WhatsApp the group. You know, trying to figure out that chain of communication, how the words gets around, is kind of that key to figuring out the cultural differences.
And what advice would you give to professionals who are leading organizational change and transformational projects in their career?
Like I said, for me, the emphasis is always big on people. But I think there is also a level where you have to recognize some people are not going to come along for a change. And, you know, it is to everybody's benefit if these people who are not coming along for a change are exited, or they leave themselves as self-selection. You know, it usually happens. Mm-hmm. The sooner this happens, the better it is. Everybody can, you know, and people are in a much happier, the people who are left also are in a happier place too.
Yeah. And you know, taking a step back to the early parts of your career, you started that in New York and London before coming back to Singapore. And while we understand that this was at, you know, different phases of your career, what were some of the working cultural differences that you have noticed moving from region to region?
So, for example, I was a banker in both New York and London. In London, it felt more collegiate. And in New York, it was collegiate as well, but, you know, subtle differences. Like, for example, when you, on Monday, mm-hmm. someone asks you, so what did you do over weekend, right? In New York, you always had to say, oh, you know, I had brunch with some friends, and, you know, I worked a couple of hours on Sunday, right? Because it was just such a work-focused culture. The idea that you had a life, the idea that you might have done something interesting with your life, at least in my industry at that time, in investment banking at that time, was just unthinkable. Whereas in London, you could say, oh, I watched a play, you know, I went for a picnic, I did something fun with my life.
And people appreciate that.
And I think that's the cultural difference. I think in America, you know, people are much more focused, very focused on work. Mm-hmm. It's either work or family. Okay. So if you're a single person, it's like, you shouldn't be having fun.
Yeah. And how would you contrast that to being here in the Southeast Asian region?
I think in Southeast Asia, people are also very focused on family. Mm-hmm. You know, but people are less, you know, there's less kind of work over the weekend thing, but very, very focused on family over here.
And more interestingly, what made you decide to return back to Singapore?
The truth, visa. I think that, you know, because globally as well, you know, visa makes it much harder for you to just do a job that you want to do versus do a job that gets you a visa. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm very happy with my decision, right? Given Brexit, the weather, the tax rate, right? And just, you know, the ease of living in Singapore and being in a very multicultural society and all the energy that is happening in Asia right now.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Which brings me to another question. What keeps you busy these days?
At the moment, I'm advising startups, mm-hmm. right? I am also doing angel investing because I spent some time in the startup world, and I really am enthused about the energy around startups. You know, the idea that people are brave enough. No, wait, one, they have an idea. Okay. They're brave enough to act on their idea. And, you know, some of these ideas will radically change our lives, or, you know, maybe some of them less radically, but, you know, solve problems for us. And thinking through how these, you know, how do I enable these?
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned that at some point in your career, you had also been supporting startups through their high growth stages. What were some of the key challenges that startups typically face during these stages? And maybe you can also outline, like, which stage were you supporting these startups at?
So I have been involved in startups from seed to series B and then seed to series BC.
Okay.
So I've seen kind of startups through the growth range, and I think there is a couple of things. So there's always startups boom and bust. Mm-hmm. You get funding, great, hooray, we're flush, let's go spend money. And then when you're like, oh crap, you know, we are running out of money, then how? And you start, you know, thinking about doomsday scenarios, how do we cut costs, how do we fire people or whatever. So it's quite difficult because on the one hand, you want to grow.
Mm.
You want that exponential growth. That's the excitement. That's what everyone's shooting for. But then how do you balance it with trying to be sustainable and not knowing when, you know, winter will come, right? And I think this is where the current high interest rate environment is hitting the startups, because, you know, it's not so easy to raise money anymore. So people really have to focus on thinking, how do I create a sustainable business model, right? And as part of that, sustainability is also for getting the right talent into startups is also a challenge, right? Because, you know, you can't just take somebody who has been an MNC for 30 years, very successful in this industry, and plant them into a startup. It's a very different mindset, right? Not everybody is also not everybody is used to the pace of being in a startup, right? So getting and then even then, you know, you have your earlier employees very excited about coming in. But as the startup scales, everybody starts moving into specialist roles. So how do you, you know, ensure that you get to keep your early talent and help them grow in their roles versus, you know, bringing in new specialists and integrating it? And also at some point, the question is, should the founder still be the CEO?
Makes a lot of sense. And you know, as you are kind of helping to drive these startups and see them through these high growth stages, I think if I'm not wrong, the roles that you've taken on is typically the CFO role in the startups that you had worked in. Maybe could you share with us, what role do you think CFOs play, especially in the early stages of the startup's growth?
Well, in the first startup I worked in, my title was CFO, but really I was Chief Non-Science Officer. Everyone else was a scientist who wore lab coats and, you know, were working in the lab. And my job was to enable them to keep working in the lab. So what does that mean? That meant that, you know, I did finance, I did HR, I did facilities, legal sometimes, you know, everything to enable them to do that.
And you know, earlier on, you were also mentioning that hiring people is quite important. You cannot just plant someone who has been very successful in a big company in a startup. What makes a good, I guess, CFO in your view, if a startup are looking to hire one?
I think this person needs to be comfortable with ambiguity. This person needs to be able to roll up their sleeves and, you know, do stuff because you will have to, you know, you'll be budget constrained, or, you know, there'll be problems that need fixing. And you need to have a reasonable understanding of how the pieces hang together. And, you know, and be willing to kind of touch into all of that stuff. So in another startup I worked in, I started getting involved in the negotiations for our commercial contracts, right? Because I realized that some of our commercial team were agreeing to terms which would cost us significantly more than the value of the contract to service. Right. So, you know, you and that's why for me, I enjoy being a Series A, B startup CFO, because you have that opportunity to get involved in much more than just finance.
And in so because you had experiences in both large-scale MNCs and also startup, which makes your profile very unique to be thriving in a startup, what, in your view, you know, has these experiences working in large-scale MNCs, how has that shaped the way you led teams and startups?
I don't think it's changed necessarily the way I lead, because I think it's the same, right? I think where the difference is that you know what a corporate structure looks like. You kind of know where the end game looks like, and you have to make a decision when you are laying the foundation, how you want to lay it. You could lay it in, you know, the, okay, I'm just going to just patch things as they go, right? And then at some point we'll deal with the problem. Or you can try to put in a bit more effort, lay a good foundation. Like, for example, you know, when we were a small startup back in the day, we made the decision that we would do audited accounts, which was really painful. But it set us up well because, you know, it made it easy to put them in a data room. It made it easy to transition to a so-called grown-up accounting audit firm later on, because we had that very good foundation that was in place from the beginning.
And you know, you had also touched on funding, which is top of mind for a lot of startups to make sure that they can continue surviving. What advice do you have for founders who are looking to raise funds, especially now? It's pretty much what they call the tech winter and has lasted for quite a while already. What advice do you have for founders who are in this journey?
I guess in this high interest rate environment, really it's everybody's looking for a sustainable business model, right? So really think hard about showing your path to profitability, right? And then I think the other question, you know, and maybe this is, do you really need a round? Can you self-fund your growth, right? I met a startup that was last raised money in 2013. And in that time, they have grown to be a $100 million revenue company, right? They have not accepted a single dollar since. I mean, for their VC, it's very frustrating because you can't mark up the value on their books. But, you know, in that time, they have also managed to not dilute, the founders have not diluted themselves, right? And yeah, so I think it's that striking that balance of, if you're raising money, what are you raising money to do? Be very clear about your objectives. Are you raising money because you want profile? Are you raising money because you want liquidity? Are you raising money because you genuinely need funds to grow? Are you raising money because you think your new investors can add other value to you? Right? And once you're clear about your objectives, then you know what to raise and who to raise from.
And you mentioned about who to raise from. Some founders might not just be thinking of raising funds from local investors. They might be looking to raise funds from international investors. How should they think about that?
I guess it depends on their industry, right? In terms of, you know, whether their industry makes sense to have an international investor. And you know, and that resonance. So I give you an example. Recently, someone approached me with a angel investing opportunity for a consumer marketing company in Nigeria. I mean, the model sounds good. You know, the write up looked good. You know, you look up the guy on LinkedIn; he looked decent. And then I was like, you know, look, I don't know anything about the Nigerian market. I don't know anything about the African market. You know. So I texted one of my business school friends who lives in Nigeria to ask more, right? And I mean, I don't think she's the expert on startups, but just getting a sense from her, it didn't sound as established. The startup actually didn't sound as established as, you know, that write-up had seemed. So it makes it difficult for an international investor that's totally unrelated to invest in you, right? But if you have a certain resonance, a certain story that makes sense to the international investor, like, you know, if you are in an industry they know well and you want to expand to their geography, then it's easier to raise money from them than cold.
And right now you are quite active in the startup scene and also angel investing and advising startups. What are some upcoming trends or developments in the industry that you have observed that you personally find very exciting or insightful?
I think everybody's talking about climate, right? Which is very interesting, very exciting. And climate is such a broad term that actually, there isn't a one kind of solution, and you know, and there's so many aspects of it. So which excites me because there's a lot of possibilities here, a lot of different riffs on it. I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how it settles, right? Where's the right place to play in the climate space? Is it going to be in food tech? Is it going to be in, you know, climate mitigation or adaptation or, you know, something even more blue ocean like seaweed cultivation?
Correct.
Yeah.
maybe just one final question from me. What's the most exciting startup that you have met or you have seen recently?
Plenty, of course.
Thank you so much. Yeah, but maybe besides our company, any others that
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay, no worries. And what's next for you in the next maybe 3 to 5 years?
For me, I want to continue being around the startup ecosystem, and, you know, continue to see companies grow. And I'm personally motivated by the situation, you know, about having a situation where I can add value and make a difference, less so about linear progression.
Okay. Yeah, very exciting. And with that, I think we wrap up today's episode. Thank you so much, Sabrina, for joining us today and sharing with us your experiences across different countries. I am very excited of what the future holds for you.
Thank you.
Rooting for you in the next few years.
Yeah, rooting for you too.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Thank you for listening to Business Beyond Borders. If you have any feedback or thoughts, do write into us at support@bluen.com. Click to follow to tune into the next episode. See you again soon.